Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Very nice to have you with us on this Thursday morning. It is a somewhat sunny Thursday. Hopefully it is where you are as well. So enjoy that. We hope you also enjoy our company as we enjoy yours for the next little while. Let me introduce our panel to you as we discuss the issues of the day, and we'll get to right to it. We are thrilled to have Joe Bonilla with us. He was with us Tuesday. He's with us today. He's a communications consultant. Joe, good morning.
Good morning, Joe. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you very much for being here. Also, professor of political science at Siena College, Vera Akarios-Kelly, joins us once again. Good morning. How are
morning,
you?
Morning, Joe. I'm doing well. Thank
Excellent.
You.
Excellent. Wonderful. Always good to have you here. And Alan Chartok joins us as well. And Alan, good morning. Are you, I'm talking to there.
Am I doing something wrong?
No, I want to get this a little closer to you.
Okay.
There you go. Okay. Hi.
Well, hello, Joe.
Is there a reason?
We have an awful lot of Joes here.
My is it me or does my mic sound weird? No, it may just be me. Okay.
You sound weird?
In my headphones, it sounds tinny, but I don't know if that's true or not.
Mm.
Okay. All right. Rob says it sounds fine where he is, and that's all I care about. Okay. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Excellent. Well, you know what? For the moment, we'll take that.
Yeah, okay.
All right. Let's move on to what is happening today and what's happening in our world. And again.
Oh, I did want to mention, I may, Joe, that I talked to the Rotary yesterday in Great Barrington. Always a great pleasure. And I said to them, because they're growing fewer in number, and I said to them, everybody seems to be growing a little older here. And they said to me, have you looked in the mirror lately?
Gentle, very gentle, sure. Let us begin with what is we're still kind of analyzing. I was going to say doing cleanup after Tuesday's elections, but what we have seen and what I would like to talk to with the panel about is how Donald Trump, the suburbs rebel against Trump, is the headline in the New York Times this morning, threatening Republicans in Congress. What does this mean from 2 years down the road or next year, really, just next year for them? And according to this article, from the tax-obsessed suburbs of New York City to high-tech neighborhoods outside of Seattle to the sprawling developments of Fairfax and Prince William County, Virginia, voters shunned Republicans up and down the ballot in off-year elections. Leaders in both parties said the elections were an unmistakable alarm bell for Republicans ahead of the 2018 campaign, when the party's grip on the House of Representatives may hinge on the socially moderate, multi-ethnic communities near major cities. Voters are taking their anger out at the president, and the only way they can do that is by going after Republicans on the ballot, according to Representative Charlie Dent, a Republican of Pennsylvania. Who agrees with Congressman Dent?
Well, it's certainly a precursor for 2018, as we saw in 2009 with Republican wins in New Jersey with Chris Christie and Bob O'Donnell in Virginia. And you saw this year with the rejection of the president's policy and also the rhetoric. It certainly bodes that next year could be incredibly difficult for Republicans in the House. They can only afford to lose 23 seats right now. And you look at those 23, there are 23 seats that Hillary Clinton won. There are an additional 13 that Barack Obama won in 2012.
And Joe, just a few months ago, we were being told by some pundits that that it was almost an insurmountable number of Republicans to beat in order to get control of the House. And now we're certainly hearing something else.
Right. And when you look at the age-old phrase, what have you done for me lately in politics, a lot can happen between now and then, whether the Republicans can actually get a substantial legislative win between now and the end of the year and then can run on that next year. That remains to be seen.
I think there is going to be a win. I think they're going to pass a tax package. And I don't think that Donald Trump himself gives a tinker's darn about what's in that tax package. He just wants to say he has a win.
Right.
And I think that's what it is.
But is that a win if nobody likes it and it's bad for the people that they're representing?
That's why the art of the deal becomes very important here, because he doesn't care about that. If he finds out that there are some things that people don't want to have happen, he'll make sure that they don't happen. For example, the deduction of state and local taxes, or somebody not being allowed to put in more money into their 401k. He's already spoken about that one. I think this is going to be a tough thing, but I think he'll give away the store, and I think that the guys in Congress will go along with him.
Except for, don't you think that once the Senate releases its own version of the tax bill, that we'll have kind of an interesting discussion coming in the next few weeks, because so much is done in private behind-the-scenes deals with, you know, lobbyists right now. And suburban voters are quite concerned that we are disadvantaging their children.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the key issues. If I had younger children right now thinking about what their future looks like, there will be, we're basically forcing future generations to pay for the debt that we'll accruing with this
an
tax
old political
deal.
Trick. Yes. Right here in New York State, Governor Cuomo is an expert at that. He keeps saying he's going to build things, but he won't be around to pay for them.
Yeah. I mean, it's really tragic when you think about all these families that are very concerned about how they will afford college tuition for their own children.
Sure.
I mean, this is one of the enormously difficult choices that suburban voters are facing.
Right. Now, we're going to talk about the tax plan in depth, but before we do that, I just don't want to move away from this of what we're looking at next year. And there's a Washington Post article this morning, very similar, about having to do with the ramifications of what happened on Tuesday and what happened in the voting. You look at places in the suburbs of Philadelphia, Delaware County, Chester County, have in the past been Republican. Republican districts have moved very much now. Democrats had a romp there on Tuesday. So what does that mean over the next year, in the sense of do we see, and this is, I guess, to Alan first, about, I understand your point about giving them something they want, but at what point do the individual representatives say, okay, this isn't good for me / my district, but more so me?
Well, they certainly are speaking out now. There are a lot, like Dent and others. They are basically not gilding the lily. Unfortunately, they're taking the wrong message from it. They say we have to do something, and that something many of us think is quite bad. And that's what you worry about. But you know, Joe, this guy has been in office for less than a year. Think about that. It's a lifetime for many of us. It's less than a year. Let's just say, and here comes the mail, let's just say he gets the North Koreans to stand down. He's going to get a lot of credit for it. Not for me, but he'll get a lot he'll get a lot of credit for it. If, in fact, he gives away the store to China, which it looks this morning like he may be doing, in order to get them to do what's needed to be done in North Korea, his numbers are going to go up. His numbers will go up.
But it would only be for a bump, though, as we've seen with other presidents where they've had, you know, foreign policy action. Mm-hmm. It might go up for maybe a few weeks, maybe a month, maybe a little bit longer, but it will go back down once people see the reality of what's happening at home.
Does that affect, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I mean, what I'm thinking about when we look at foreign policy issues, maybe President Trump will somehow find some opportunity to figure out a temporary arrangement in North Korea. But besides North Korea, we have an enormously complex challenge emerging, exploding on the scene with Saudi Arabia and Iran right now that President Trump stirred up in one of his tweets just 2 days ago. We have the Saudi prince, the youngest prince ever to be in power in Saudi Arabia. He's only in his early 30s, Mohammed bin Salman. He was endorsed by President Trump just 2 days ago in his process to amass power and take complete control. Not that we're thinking that Saudi Arabia has been such a diverse and democratic environment, but let's just say in a dictatorship, President Trump has just endorsed a young prince who is full force encouraging war against Yemen has now closed the borders. The UN considers this the most pressing humanitarian crisis in the world. We now have extreme water and food insecurity in the region. And this prince has arrested other princes that are very important international investors. Anybody who was competition within the Wahhabi regime is now under arrest. Internal competition is gone.
It's a consolidation of power, right? I mean, that's what we're seeing
in Saudi. Yes.
So contrast that to the reaction. You talked about the reaction from this president.
Mm-hmm.
Contrast that to the reaction from leaders elsewhere around the world.
Yes. There's profound and deep concern because Prince bin Salman has consolidated all the intelligence services under his control. They were diversified in terms of its control. He is very aggressive in his pursuit and blaming of Iran. So what we see is an Iranian reach with a combination, obviously, in connections to Syria, Assad. Now that the ISIS is, lost its strongholds, its territory. So there's an alliance between Assad, Iran, and the Shia government of Iraq versus, the Sunni side, which is strongly supported by President Trump, led by the Saudis. So what we have is the potential for a very explosive situation in the Middle East between the two Muslim communities.
Well, so I have another question for you because of your expertise on this question. The press has been giving sort of a break to the Saudis
mm-hmm.
now by saying this young prince's reaction has to do more with corruption that people are disgusted with than with the consolidation of power. So are they wrong?
I think it's a really interesting idea to talk about corruption in Saudi Arabia, where the entire elite princess class has enormous resources and no rules really exist in terms of what you can do with that money. You can invest it. I mean, the current prince who accuses his political opponents of corruption, he goes out and buys a yacht from a Russian billionaire for $500 million, when he sees the yacht and likes it. I mean, I don't know what the rules are in Saudi Arabia on corruption. I don't think they have defined it inside in terms of their regulatory state. So it's it's a fascinating topic.
So my question to you, Vera, is then, is how have our press been hoodwinked, on
this? It's not that the press has been hoodwinked in a sense that Saudi Arabia is so complex, has a tribal structure, is based on Wahhabism in terms of a very traditional faith structure. Power connections and bloodline is so important that you really have to have an expert to dissect what is going on domestically. So intelligence services have pointed to two options in the next couple of months. Either Prince Mohammed bin Salman will be in control of Saudi Arabia for the next decades and perhaps pursue a modernization agenda, or other princes and Wahhabi clerics might go after him and remove him, and we might see new leadership in the next couple of months. Mm-hmm.
John Alterman of the Center for Strategic and International Studies says what we're seeing now is Saudi Arabia is willing to take risks. What's different is that the Saudis are willing to fight in a way the Saudis haven't been willing to fight before. So when you look at that, bringing it back to our earlier conversation before we go to a break, what impact do you think that has on Donald Trump and his support of this action?
Okay, but before, because I want to add a coda to your very good question, Joe, and that is, Remember, this is a president who seems to like dictators to begin with.
Right, he seems jealous.
Right, this consolidation of power, his endorsement of consolidation of power.
He obviously had a very nice visit in Saudi Arabia, his first foreign trip. And if you remember, he enjoyed the pomp and circumstance. And the prince welcomed him warmly. And this was the closest connection President Trump had to a foreign leader besides, obviously, the president of China. So he does seem to get along with people that have full control of their countries and the economies in those countries and the populations. So he seems to understand this kind of pomp and circumstance, and he loves the control these people have. And I think President Trump entirely lacks a deeper understanding of what is going on domestically in Saudi Arabia and how that will permeate the entire region.
Well, but I would come back to you and ask you this. How do we know that? I mean, I think the guy knows exactly what's going on in those countries and doesn't care a bit because, as Joe has just said, as you've said, he admires this model.
Well, he might, except for the American public. What this translates into is that the Saudis will rely on U.S. military power and U.S. personnel to fight a war. I'm not quite sure that is what the American voter was endorsing when they elected President Trump.
So just as I mentioned, we're going to be going into a break in about a minute. But as we look at the effect of what we saw on Tuesday, the election, and I was going to ask just the silliest question in the world, which is, you know, do you think we'll see any changes from Trump? But I don't assume that will happen, Joe.
I don't think we'll see that. I think if anything, you know, he will make it now into overdrive, this
still
push
them.
For a deal, whatever the deal looks like.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. This is not a guy who learns from his mistakes. At least I don't think he does.
Well, he doesn't make mistakes, remember?
Yeah. He never does.
Yeah. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll go to news. When we come back, we will continue our conversation. We have a lot of other topics to talk about. We'll talk about the tax plan in depth. Plus, we will also talk about other issues and welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Vera Akarios-Kelly, and Joe Bonilla on the panel this morning. We will continue our conversation after this short break. Playing a little WC this morning as we remind you that the Katzbahn Gala is happening Passion for Dance Saturday, November 11th at 6 p.m. at the Black Box Theater in Katzbahn in Tivoli, New York. Performance features the New York Theater Ballet with Joan Tower and Michael Scales. And there'll be a lot going on at that event. And just wanted to remind you of that. And thank you very much. We'll be listening to more WC during our breaks, so thank you. People have been asking about the music, so we'll answer that question right off the bat. We have other letters too. Let's go to those.
Yeah, we do, and we want to thank our wonderful Sarah LeDuc for doing the culling and bringing them in.
The collation.
Also some culling there. I think that's that is
collation.
Collation. I think that's important. Okay. So I'll read you some. Vera from Roxanne says, Vera. Hello, I wanted to say I think Vera, sorry I can't remember her last name.
Akarios-Kelly.
Is a great addition to the panel, so knowledgeable and an excellent communicator. Thank you from Roxanne. That's
thank you, Roxanne.
Nice. Trump says race, so says Nick from Queensburg. Governor's races had nothing to do with Trump. Hillary won those areas. Why would we expect Trump to win in those areas? And then on another subject, Cuomo is running for governor again. The bills will hit sooner or later. We need to term limit that bully and get him out of office, is the letter.
Yeah.
Tough
yeah.
letter. Dan says, the media seems hyper-focused on Tuesday's election results as an anti-Trump statement without laying equal, in capital letters, blame on the congressional GOP. In Virginia, the number one issue at 39% was health care. We mentioned that yesterday,
Joe. It's definitely true. I mean, they're the issues-related voters out there. You know, we have emphasized right now that there are a lot of, you know, diverse, you know, candidates. Right. And you know, but in fact, it is very important to look at the agenda items that that people voted for, and they are simply interested in, you know, educational questions, environmental issues. Some areas had traffic congestion as a major concern. So, I mean, there are a lot of issues that people have voted for and came out for.
And yet there are signs all over, according to the newspapers, saying vote against Trump.
Right.
So, you know, that counts for something. But, Vera, I think you really are onto something here with the health care. A point that Teresa made, I think, yesterday also, which is when you're going to take something away that you've already given to people, that's a rough one. And if you say to somebody, you know, you've been able to deduct your state and local taxes and keep your tax bill down, but now in the Senate bill now, the new Senate bill, you won't be allowed to do that at all. You know, somebody says, okay, well, that's going to cost me several thousand dollars, and I don't want that. So we tend to dismiss this, as you say, the specific issues that make people vote one way or another. Dan says, good morning, panel.
Good morning.
The media seems hyper-focused on Tuesday's election. We did that, right? Yes, we did.
Yes.
Okay, and the second part of that sentence was, the public knows, and Paul Ryan just said it publicly, we're with Trump, confirming the GOP complicity. And that's from Dan in Altamont. Lee says, take care, faced with a belligerent leader who loves military parades and is dead set on amassing a more lethal nuclear arsenal, we need to employ more effective safeguards, and maybe we should worry about North Korea too, and that's Lee in Modena. And George says, elections. Half the population in Northern Virginia works for the federal government. Half of Northern New Jersey depends on Wall Street and the economy of New York City, two constituencies that may begin to give Trump his comeuppance. But it's the South and the Mideast, stupid. That's where Trump won. And that's the constituency that won't be turned by crowing in the New York Times. And that's from George in Kingston.
Yeah, what I wanted to mention a couple of things. So I lived in the past in Minnesota, for example. So, you know, there are parts of Minnesota that are quite conservative, obviously, and all, you know, but there are some candidates, especially on sort of city council membership, when you look at urban environments, towns, as well as in Montana. We saw, for example, a Liberian refugee in Helena, Montana, rise to the mayoral position. So I don't think it's quite accurate to say that the sort of so-called insurgencies happen in big urban environments among, you know, sort of the more diverse communities. It is also happening in some ways across the Midwest now.
Well, you also see in the South, you saw in Georgia, there were two state House seats that were also taken by Democrats that had not been taken in decades. But, you know, it's not really an organized strategy by Democrats. They're running on this overall theme of resist, and it's not organized in the same way as you saw like in 94 with the contract with America, with Republican leadership. So I think, you know, as we see the next few weeks and obviously the months going into the midterm, whether or not the Democrats can actually have a coalesced message to take back the House and the Senate, that's what really needs to be seen.
Well, you know, you're such an expert on this show, so I wanted to ask you this. Doesn't there have to be a diversity of messages as opposed to a single message? I mean, it's got to be a big tent. And some people will turn people on with a state and local taxes message. And some people will turn people on with an equality message. I think that there is this growing sense among people that there has to be one message from the Democrats, and I worry about that.
I wouldn't say necessarily one message, but it should be at least 2 to 3 solid points that they can run on. Obviously, you know, we talk about this big tent party, but when you start splintering and start, you know, really getting into the weeds about, you know, what issue is what, you know, good for somebody who lives in North Dakota versus somebody who lives in the suburbs of New York City and then vice versa, you have to be able to at least talk to what affects them in their everyday life. And for a number of voters, you know, local issues still percolate on the federal level where they will still vote their values, but not necessarily in the same way.
Mm. But let me just say that the New York Times analysis mm-hmm. of all of this is fascinating. Suburban voters who can go either way went against the Republicans this time. And women were a huge group of people. There were a lot of white women who voted for Trump back in the last election. And there's been a real break. Now, I think that Saturday Night Live has a great deal to do with this because people are embarrassed by this guy. I think in addition to what you said, Vera, which is so true about individual issues, I think there's a sense among college educated and other people that this guy is a disaster for this country. And he's really an embarrassment and they don't want him here anymore. So we're watching the break, Joe. You mentioned this before about where, but we're watching it in the suburbs. And now, of course, if he wins everything he won the last time, he wins again.
Right.
But I don't think he will.
No. But even if you saw, let's say, the Democrats take another 20 seats but still don't have the majority in the House, it may not be enough. And at that point, you're looking at the reelection campaign 2020, whether or not the House election and House Senate elections for next year actually make a bellwether for that. But then you could see Trump rebound in 2019. Maybe he might actually get some things done.
Yeah. Well, that's right. Anything did happen in this first year. That's the whole point.
Right.
And anything can happen.
It was a year ago today we were talking about on this show the election of Donald Trump as president.
So amazing.
Oh, wow.
Hard to believe that it's been
a year.
Yes,
it is.
It's hard to believe it's been a year, and yet it seems like 5 years.
It does.
Yeah.
Because there's been so much. There's been so much shoved into that period of time. It has not been a slow news cycle.
But I do think that Ellen is right that among highly educated voters, college educated voters, and suburban families, it's very clear that people are profoundly embarrassed by President Trump's conduct. He endangers the future of this, the economic future of this country, the stability of middle class families, the educational opportunities for children, the environment. Nearly everyone in suburbia will identify an issue that they're really concerned about for their own futures.
Including, Vera, if you think about this, mm-hmm. a guy lives out in Amityville, Long Island, I'm making that up, and has a little box, two bedroom box of a house. Okay. And he or she is paying $25,000 in taxes on the little box. Now, at least if you could deduct that from your state and local taxes, you got a little bit of a break.
Right, right.
And now they want to take that away. So that is a target person, for Trump.
I would agree. I mean, these are the possibly among the people that had thought our tax burden might be seriously reduced, and now it looks like that is not going to happen for middle class and lower middle class. Actually, seems to be targeted by this tax bill.
Right, and I think if you look at next year, I mean, tax deductions in terms of this whole issue could be the new Affordable Care Act of what we saw in 2010.
You're right,
that's a good point.
Right.
You're
mm-hmm.
right, and I want to ask both of you, our communications expert and our expert political scientist here, what you make of the ability to do just what you just said, Joe, to make the argument that this is a substantive issue which you better pay attention to, as opposed to the amorphous "I hate Trump, I like Trump" kind of stuff. In other words, how much can we count on people to really get it, and then to transfer that to maybe people who do not study it the way that this college-educated quote elite does?
Well, I think if you look at the way that we're going forward in terms of analyzing this election for what is going to be worthwhile for next year, you look at these suburban voters, they are the true swing voters and the impact that they have upon what we're looking for. But what comes down to it is what affects them in their wallet, what affects them in their neighborhood. And you're going to look at voters next year where if this is truly what we believe it could very well be in terms of the devastating impact it would have for somebody's family, this will really make a difference in terms of looking into the slog of the midterm election in the next summer.
No doubt.
Go ahead.
No, I mean, I so agree. I absolutely think personal budgeting issues are essential to voting decisions. I mean, this will decide the direction of this country.
Yeah, because when you're done, we got to go. But when mm-hmm. you're done doing your tax, or the tax preparer gives you yep. that's back, and you're paying $2,000 or $3,000 more, that's going to make a big difference to people.
I mean, that is an immediate outcome. You can see this, you know, and the promise that in the future you might get a few hundred dollars here or there back. That's not going to convince voters.
Right.
It's the tax bill.
Right.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue, and we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, Alan Chartok, Joe Bonilla, and Vera Akarios-Kelly with us this morning. We welcome your letters, and we'll read those and move on to other topics right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Let us talk for just a moment while we are before we move on to other issues, sort of domestic issues. I would like to talk about what's happening in Great Britain find out what is happening with Theresa May. A second shuffle of cabinet in a very few days, and a major resignation. And doesn't this all basically get down to Brexit and the difficulties?
It does. I mean, this is fascinating. Well, while we think, you know, President Trump in our your realm of consciousness is a nightmare. The Brits have the Brexit issue, and Theresa May made this horrendous decision to call for a snap election last year. She lost support, miscalculating. She's also not a very effective communicator on certain issues. She went after her own voting base, and then the elderly voters, and said there was a need for cutting benefits, especially in healthcare, so that didn't work out for her. But she also doesn't control her cabinet very well. She has some very serious management issues. So we see the resignation of the minister for international.
Michael Fallon resigned as defense secretary last week
because of sexual harassment issues.
Right.
And then
Priti Patel
was the one who resigned, the international development secretary.
That's it, international development secretary. She went off on a vacation to Israel and had unapproved private meetings with a number of Israeli officials without the approval of the foreign secretary nor the prime minister. Now, you know, it's kind of interesting to see that. I'm not surprised she was pushed into this resignation. But here's the main thing. What is happening with Theresa May? She's supposed to negotiate the Brexit agreement. The European Union officials are saying, well, you don't seem to have a lot of public support. Now your cabinet is in disarray. Who are we negotiating with, and what do you actually hope to achieve? EU officials are pushing back. There are a number of voting constituencies in the UK that are saying maybe this Brexit referendum wasn't even representing the majority of the British population. Only 70% of eligible voters participated. There are parts of the UK, such as in Scotland, Northern Ireland, and certainly the major financial center of London, where people voted to remain in the European Union. And so we have this fracturing of UK constituencies, and she is not holding it together.
Well, I guess the question I would have for you, and maybe, you know, in your expertise, do you think that she has longevity as prime minister, because you look at basically the effects of Brexit with David Cameron.
Yes.
And certainly now she's feeling the effects of actually trying to execute.
Well, and let me add to that question, or as Alan calls it, a coda. I like that. which is that it's been called a make or break month for her, basically conservatives giving her to Christmas to get her act together.
Yeah, and it's looking tougher and tougher with her ministers evaporating from our cabinet. So she has very little time left. She's profoundly unpopular in the UK. There is a pushback against the Conservatives to even pursue what is now called a soft Brexit, not the hard Brexit, the immediate break-off, but the negotiated softening of the blow, especially by the constituency in London, which is dominated by the banking and financial sector. So my brother happens to be living in Frankfurt, Germany, and there's a noticeable increase of international capital coming to Frankfurt, leaving London. So there is a profound fear that London might use 100,000 plus highly educated people and jobs in the financial sector.
So as our resident German understander, my question to you, Vera, is is that going to help Merkel? The fact that so many people and so many financial places are coming into Germany?
Well, so the question for her is not so much the economy, because it's strong. She, of course, could benefit more if Frankfurt becomes the European capital for finance. But her issue is she still has not yet completed her coalition negotiations after her re-election. So she needs to work on what is called the Jamaica coalition with, the potential Green Party, her conservatives, and then another partner.
Is she between a rock and a hard place?
Well, she wants to keep out the right wing. She wants to make sure she has a stable coalition, so they have to come to an agreement on a number of issues. And the Social Democrats have pulled out. They want to be an opposition party to save themselves from oblivion. So everybody's going through negotiation processes, and it looks like Angela Merkel might pull it out. I think Theresa May have more of a vacation period over Christmas than she anticipated. I'm not sure, of course. But we don't know. I shouldn't say. I mean, it was just a joke, but I don't know, obviously.
I know Joe wants to get on, and I don't blame him. But Merkel, just in bottom line, is she in charge? In other words, is she playing with it, or is she in real danger?
Oh, no. I think she'll be holding the center of Europe.
The other thing, though, just in the larger picture, because a year ago we were looking at this election, the Trump election, we were looking at, we were still coming out of Brexit, and all of this change within the world of coming up and for want of a better term, but drain the swamp of however that manifests itself in the various cultures and countries. And now it seems to be, the question always was, everybody said, okay, well, now you have to govern. Now you actually have to do it. And we're learning that's not easy and that's hard. So even if, let's say, even if Theresa May does have a long Christmas vacation and it doesn't go, then what? I mean, you're just sort of setting the next person up for disaster, aren't you?
Well, but that goes on here, too. So,
well, that's exactly right.
Exactly. So you may take Virginia. You know, a guy says, well, we don't like the other guy. Throw him out. Mm. And we'll put a Democrat in there. Now the Democrats got to do something. New Jersey, same thing. These are not easy states, especially with the Trump agenda.
And how patient are the people going to be? Right.
Well, I mean, also I find it fascinating. Just a few weeks ago, we were sort of, I thought, at a crisis point with NAFTA. All of a sudden, we're just in negotiations. Right. We don't know what's going on. There's no progress, I'm not sure where we are with the
he
number of
He does not blame
issues.
China for the trade deficit.
No.
Right.
Oh, and he has great things to say about the Chinese premier.
Yes.
I mean, that is... He could not have been more effusive. Mm. And then they play back. What's great about tape now is they play back all
yes.
the things
everything
said
he said
during
on
the
campaign.
Yeah. Yeah.
And even not that long ago. I mean, not even as president.
He used the R word. He said rape. China had raped the United States.
He did, multiple times.
Yeah. Well, I mean. Reality check. I think people, voters are now remembering. They're watching the tape. They're going, wait a minute, you promised things, and now we actually see you're not keeping your word. We were quite forgiving in terms of your, you know, veering off on bizarre topics and insulting, you know, various people. But now, really look at our pocketbook. You're not coming through.
Right.
So to me, I'm sorry, Joe, but the real question here is, we have a group of people who watch Fox exclusively. They don't listen to NPR, and they, unless they're in the cars. They don't listen to NPR. They watch Fox exclusively. Mm. They don't watch CNN, and they certainly don't watch MSNBC for this thing. Is there enough of a group between the sort of liberal orientation and the other, the Fox group, so that there's a marginal group who will make the difference in the elections? Joe?
Well, I think there's certainly a group out there that could do it. But, you know, what it comes down to is the attention span of voters. They look at what's happening in between each election. And when you look at the issues that can percolate, what issues are trumped up and promoted in that span, what issues affect folks, and who is able to win the media battle, if you will, that's really going to be the determinant about who wins next year.
I also think it matters that young people are beginning to be re-engaged with the political process.
Interesting.
And young people, I mean post-college.
And what's that about?
So I wanted to mention, I'm going to do a shout-out to one of my former students from Siena who was elected to city council in Troy, David Besember. So it's nice to see young people stepping up, running for elections, trying to make a difference, and now making a difference in their own communities. So they are re-inspired to stand up for values that affect young people and their own futures.
Right. And I think, but at the same time, you look at almost a sliding scale in this, in the peaks and valleys of youth involvement and youth engagement in elections. And you saw that with the election of Barack Obama 9 years ago. And then you saw 2 years later, they stayed home.
Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll get to letters. Alan has quite a stack in front of him, so we'll get to those, and then we'll move on to some other topics as well. We welcome your responses. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. Thank you, Ray. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Joe Bonilla, and Vera Akarias-Kelly. We are welcoming your letters, panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. We'd love to hear from you. And we have a whole stack, so we'll get to those, and Alan will begin.
Okay, gang, just jump in anytime, Vera, Joe, anytime you have a comment, just tell us. Joseph says, alimony deduction. Alan's comments on the loss of the property tax deduction prompts me to ask the panel, what do you think of the loss of the alimony deduction, a subject of interest to me? Thank you. And that's right. You know, a lot of people, the child care, other things that may affect a smaller slice, but are number one on people's list because of where they are.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of deductions on the table that people are worried about. Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Denise says, black woman's vote in Virginia. I was grateful to see that black women voting for Democrats pulled Democrats over the finish line in Virginia in the exit polls. However, it was disturbing to see how many of my white sisters voted for Republicans. We have work to do. Denise in Saugerties. Mm.
Well, I think, you know, you'll see, you know, in any state, or especially Virginia, where, you know, it will shift from, you know, year to year, election to election.
Sure.
So, you know, certainly based upon the values and the issues of the day.
Yeah. Michael says, panel, if local property taxes are outrageous, then local people need to feel the burden before they will vote to change it. If one town or county or state has voted for high taxes, then let them pay them. They shouldn't be looking to other towns, counties, and states to subsidize their own fiscal decisions.
I mean, to a degree, I mean, you can't, like, work in a vacuum in that sense. Mm.
Well, but if you keep, no, I mean, I think the point of the letter, which, of course, I don't agree with, but the point, because we have a high school we have to rebuild in Great Barrington, in my opinion, and it keeps going down, keeps failing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's important to have a high school that people mm-hmm. will sit in that won't be dripping on their heads. The mm-hmm. water won't be dripping on their heads and the rest of it. But those decisions get made. Sometimes they get made too expensively.
Right.
And then, you know, what do you do?
But it's also the funding formula. We had a similar issue here in Albany where we had high school rebuilding, we had middle school rebuilding, and it came down to the way that the funding formula, the aid formula came down to in terms of the cost over time. So,
And John says, while we are talking about Brexit, the most disturbing development of Brexit, the creation of hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic, could this aggravate
yeah, I'm sure.
the peace that has held up for so long, John? And as Joe says, John, and I hope you don't take this the wrong way, read it once before you send it. Okay, and then...
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. This is actually a huge problem for families that have yeah. connections across the border, and... this may actually allow, you know, really serious levels of violence to rise again, because yeah. the Republic of Ireland, of course, is a member of the European Union. If Northern Ireland will be forced to participate in a separation, right. a divorce from the European Union, that also means trade across Northern Ireland and the Republic right. will change. Relationships will change. This is a very serious issue that affects communities and the level of violence in those communities. There is little doubt about major concerns about re-engagement with potential elements of civil war.
Yeah, and Joe Donahue, next time we have Richie Neal on, who is our resident Irish expert. He really knows his stuff yes. here, Congressman Richie Neal. Mm-hmm. We have to ask him about this, mm-hmm. okay? Clueless writes, not one single woman I know who voted for Trump is embarrassed by him or considering voting for anybody else next time. Get out of your bubble, panel. I put the panel part in.
Well, I disagree. I know I have friends in the Midwest that have voted for Trump for economic reasons and have now reconsidered. I mean, so I have friends in the Midwest that are in that position. So
right. And then similar feeling where you had folks that voted uh-huh. for Hillary and then they actually are regretting their decision, actually. Yeah. And so uh-huh. but it depends on what your value are, your way
exactly.
of life, everything like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Paul writes, lame Democrats. Good morning, panel.
Good morning.
You hear no voice of leadership from Democrats. You have no articulated vision for the country or even a short-term agenda for the Democratic Party. There is a groundswell of angry voters taking action, but there is no coherent Democratic leadership taking charge and providing an alternative vision for America, a, quote, layup opportunity, but no talented leader taking a shot. And that's from Paul. Well, you know, I don't know that that's true, Paul. I mean, you know, you take a number of Democratic leaders, Chris Murphy in Connecticut or Chuck Schumer for some people, and they've been quite articulate about what needs to be done. You may not think so, but the real question is, do others? Rose says, budget. Hi, panel. I'm not sure if you've gotten to this, but did you know the GOP tax plan will make a graduate school tuition waivers? Let me start again. I'm so sorry. Hi, panel. I'm not sure if you've gotten to this, but did you know the GOP tax plan will make graduate school tuition waivers eligible for taxes, a.k.a. a student with a $30,000 stipend and $30,000 in waivers, school covers it, will get taxed on $60,000 of income, increasing their tax bracket and the amount owed when they don't have an income above their stipend. Many fear their owed taxes will easily double or more. They're talking about quenching higher ed. Keep on fighting the good fight, and that's from Rose in Philly.
Well, that goes back to the thing about, you know, each of these deductions, like, it affect different people in different parts of their life. So certainly when it comes to graduate students and the waivers, you know, that's something where it affects that person, where the individual who spoke earlier, or basically we had the letter earlier about alimony taxes, the same thing.
Well, but, you know, I find it particularly disturbing, I must say, as somebody who is a professor and works with students, the issue that we're completely missing in this country at the moment is that students are already suffering from challenges related to the cost of living and paying tuition and being able to pay back their loans. And here we are punishing students again, possibly, for having stipends.
Yes, but what, I mean, you're, what?
We don't value education in this country.
Right. You're absolutely right. The question, therefore, is why? Why are they doing that?
Because I guess we prefer to give tax breaks to corporate interests because supposedly they will create future jobs for, I don't know whom, impoverished, you know, graduate school students who can't pay back their loans unless they take a corporate job. I really am at a loss that we don't think about the future of our young people.
Well, let me try it on you this way. Let me try this one on you. First of all, I don't think you're right in the word we. I think what you want to say is the Republicans, because they're the ones who are calling the shots, you know, on this. And what is it about those Republicans that see higher education as such an anathema? Is it that they took a look at these elections and saw where those students and people of that group are likely to be in another camp than their own? And therefore, okay, this is punishment time.
Right, and then therefore would provide the disincentive for somebody going to graduate school because they believe demographically they will vote against them in the upcoming election.
And by the way, they will.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, sort of we need to refocus on a pro-science agenda and a pro-education agenda in this country. And by that, I mean we as in the leadership and everybody from elementary school all the way up to graduate school. The future of this country depends on our human resources. And that includes spending some serious money on educational efforts, including repairing buildings that you mentioned, Alan, and educational opportunities for those that can't afford it on their own.
But not with Betsy DeVos, right? And not with, you know, the kinds of reactionary group that is in power right now and will be, by the way, for the next 3 years at very least, unless, of course, somebody writes me a letter about how Trump is going to get impeached. Okay. Trump base and tax plan. Good morning, panel. I try to keep abreast of Trump's base and how propaganda is impacting them, but they appear to be silent on the tax plan. Do you think they are falling for the rhetoric of tax cuts for the middle class, or are they starting to push back finally? And that's from Alan in Medina.
No, I think certainly there's a bit of truth in the belief of these tax cuts. And if you keep on saying it 300 or 400 times, they believe it would come true. But I think when they really see the true impact of what these cuts and obviously the changes in deduction
to them,
yes. Correct, that they may actually start to think, well, maybe what I've heard 100 million times may not be actually what it actually is.
Good morning, panel. How in the world can people support any Republican tax plan which increases our national debt and does nothing to invest in a much-needed infrastructure investment in our country? Any tax reform action should be contingent upon our disturbed president's release of his own tax returns. Thanks from John. All right. Michael says, medical expenses and nursing home care for aging boomers. Please address the potential impact of abandoning the medical expense deduction, especially as it impacts seniors living in nursing homes where costs may be as high as $120,000. Aging boomers will put additional pressure on public resources if they go through their savings more quickly without the deduction. And that's Mike from Clifton Park. It's a very interesting point, which is what they've done is to make medical deductions almost the thing of the past for anybody who's making a middle-class salary. You can't do it because it's just so much higher. But if you're in a nursing home and you're done with that productive time of your life, then those deductions mean a great deal.
Right.
Yeah.
When you're on a fixed income, you know, when costs are going to continue to rise, you know, these sorts of things make a huge impact.
And this ought to give people a sleepless night.
Right.
Just thinking about that.
Sure. And Jude says, And the women who exposed Weinstein et al., the women who exposed Weinstein et al. Have given the white women who voted for Trump a reason to wake up, thank God. And Thomas says, or Tom, it's not about one issue, it's about focus. Democrats should advocate for universal health care, a tax structure that lifts those in need to have hope for improvement in their lives, and Democrats should not forget the words of Tip O'Neill that all politics is local. Interesting. Max says, where's the Democratic tax plan? Good morning, panel. Simple question. Where's the Democratic alternative tax plan? Why are they letting the Republicans define the moment? Mac from Conway, Massachusetts. Well, Mac, here's the problem. They have the power. They've got the votes. And so the Democrats are talking. I mean, Chuck Schumer talks about this daily.
Right.
About where what has to happen. And James says, Democratic program, Democratic issues, LGBT rights, pro-choice, illegal aliens, no issue there that interests the voter, plus no issues, only opposition to bread and butter issues. And that's from James. And that's what we got, Joe.
All right. I do want to get to this topic because I find it, well, I find it a lot of things. interesting, troubling. This has to do with the Justice Department and the deal that says, okay, if you're going to have this this sale that takes place, and please do not think that this is personal, right? If you're going to do this Time Warner AT&T sale,
yes. Uh-huh.
You have to get rid of CNN.
But it's bigger than just CNN.
It is bigger than CNN. Right. It's a lot bigger.
This is the Trump and the Trump Justice Department saying this, right?
But this is the question. So AT&T, the telecommunications giant, and Time Warner, the owner of CNN, HBO, Warner Brothers, all this content, together these two companies would create a colossus straddling the worlds of internet access, news, and entertainment. It was a pending $85.4 billion acquisition. On Wednesday, however, tensions between the Justice Department and executives of the two companies spilled out into the open. Now it seems possible that the Justice Department and AT&T will end up battling each other in court. The ongoing negotiations have also demonstrated how the Trump administration may regulate big-ticket mergers and acquisitions, representing the first major test for the government's antitrust strategy. A central component of the dispute, according to people from both companies and the Justice Department, is CNN, the network that Mr. Trump has frequently attacked as a purveyor of fake news. Late last week, AT&T called the Justice Department to request a meeting between top antitrust officials and AT&T's chief executive officer, Randall Stephenson. On Monday at the Justice Department headquarters in Washington, Stephenson and AT&T's general counsel met. And now I have an ad from American Airlines. We'll move on. They met at Justice Department headquarters in Washington. And in one account of the meeting, Justice Department officials called on AT&T to sell Turner Broadcasting, a group of cable channels under the Time Warner banner that includes CNN, as a potential requirement for gaining government approval.
What's interesting about this is that Randall Stephenson, the CEO of AT&T, said he never offered to sell CNN as part of the deal. But then you also had the new assistant attorney general who then said, no, this was part of the deal. So basically, the bigger question is, and as far as I know, in terms of having one specific asset being removed, and specifically where it comes to the president, who has, he always has labeled CNN as the original fake news, that whether or not this goes through, this actually certainly has an impact on terms of mergers and acquisitions moving forward, and obviously those that require Justice Department approval.
Hmm. So, but don't you think, I mean, does it come down, so those of us looking from the outside, is it as simple as Donald Trump saying, I don't like them, do something to stop this?
Well, what's interesting is that the White House is denying any sort of influence in terms of the Justice Department on the issue.
And we can trust that because Trump never lies.
Oh, of course not. But what's interesting, too, is that the deal, this merger was announced in October of 2016, and candidate Trump was against the deal before it even began.
And so what do you think is going to happen? Any idea?
Really what comes down to is that they were hoping to wrap up this deal by the end of the year. Whether or not it can actually happen
seems unlikely.
It doesn't seem unlikely unless Turner Broadcasting is removed from it. But then the question is, who do they get to buy Turner? And whether it's a media company that might be closer to the president's agenda and certainly can, you know, make those influences in terms of CNN brass, that could certainly happen.
All right. Well, what happens to the reruns of Pixie and Dixie?
Well,
those are the most important questions.
That's really what I'm worried about.
Who
were Pixie and Dixie?
Pixie and Dixie were a Hanna-Barbera cartoon as part of the Banana Splits, Alan.
And the Bananas.
It's part of the Cartoon Network.
Oh, okay.
And Boomerang, too.
And Boomerang, that's right. Well, I guess Boomerang is the...
Boomerang is the...
It's all part of the Turner family.
I got it.
Yes. TNT, the movie classics. Turner movie. This affects your life, Alan.
It's the only thing I watch.
That affects your life. You got to pay attention to this. This affects your life.
I watch the old movie channel.
All right. So my thanks to Vera and to Joe and to Alan and to you, of course, for writing. Panel at WAMC.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.